You're listening to Vermont Edition. I'm Michaela Lafrac. Today, we're taking a look at how Vermont's legislation on reproductive rights fits into the national debate and the legal landscape. This spring, the Texas legislature passed a law that bans abortion after a doctor detects a fetal heartbeat, which is usually at about 6 weeks of pregnancy. On September 1st, the U.S. Supreme Court refused to block the law, making it the most restrictive abortion measure in the country. Later this fall, the court could take up a new case to decide whether Roe v. Wade should be overruled. Here in Vermont, abortion rights activists have been working for years to codify reproductive protections, including a constitutional amendment. Anti-abortion activists have not backed down either. Today, we're taking a look at this current state of the abortion rights debate. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-800-639-2211. You can also email us at vermontedition@vpr.org or tweet us at vermontedition. We're joined first today by University of Vermont political science professor Ellen Anderson. Professor Anderson teaches courses in constitutional law, the politics of sexuality, and American politics. Welcome to the program.
Hi there.
Hi. So let's start first with Texas. Its new law bans abortion starting at about 6 weeks after the patient's last menstrual period. Can you tell us how the Texas law is structured? Who enforces it, for example?
All right. So Texas's law is extremely unusual in that it is not enforced by state officials. There's no state agency that enforces it. Instead, the law passes enforcement over to the general public. It's not a criminal law, it's a civil law. So basically what that means is anyone in the public can sue, not the person who actually seeks to terminate her pregnancy, but anybody who assists or tries to assist her in terminating her pregnancy. So we're talking about, obviously, doctors, abortion clinics, but, the Uber driver who takes you, the sister who takes you. So the idea is that those people are suable by average citizens, regular citizens in Texas. And the setup is that you can bring a suit in a regular courtroom. And if the person who brings the suit wins, they get $10,000. And the loser has to pay the attorney's fees for the winner. But if you are a doctor or a clinic who is performing abortions and say you win because you didn't perform an abortion after 6 weeks, you don't get anything. You don't get your lawyer's fees covered. You don't get $10,000. The law is completely structured to create a situation where it's very easy to harass people that you think are assisting in pregnancy terminations.
And so the way that it is structured is I assume, the reason why abortion rights, reproductive rights activists have called it something of a bounty hunting situation.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, so the idea is, you have become empowered to go after somebody. And if you are and if you win, you get $10,000.
So 2 weeks ago, the Supreme Court refused to block the law by a vote of 5-4. And the court is now majority conservative, and three of the conservative justices were appointed by President Donald Trump. And this has all led to concerns among abortion rights activists that Roe v. Wade, the landmark 1973 decision that protects a woman's right to choose, could be overturned by the court in the not too distant future. Do you think that that's possible?
Oh, I think it's very possible. I think the only question is whether the right to abortion is sort of killed off by sort of death through a thousand cuts, or whether or not it's speared through the heart in a manner of speaking. So it's possible that this court might literally overturn Roe versus Wade and Planned Parenthood versus Casey. Those are the two big Supreme Court decisions that anchor the right to abortion. They might overturn it entirely. It's, I still think, somewhat more likely that they will just permit incredibly onerous restrictions on the right to abortion, such that effectively that right no longer exists.
Now, Professor Anderson, let's connect the dots here to Vermont. If the Supreme Court does rule on Roe v. Wade, what changes about women's access to reproductive rights here in Vermont?
Well, nothing immediately. Vermont doesn't have a law that says, you know, in the event that Roe versus Wade is overturned, we are going to criminalize abortion in this state. So, you know, if Roe versus Wade were overturned tomorrow, people who were planning to terminate their pregnancy, had appointments to terminate their pregnancies, would still be able to go ahead and terminate their pregnancies. Right, because in the absence of a law saying you can't do something, generally you can do it. On the other hand, that would make it incredibly easy for a legislature to sort of move to start to create limitations on the right to abortion. It would certainly make it very easy for various facilities, like public facilities that do abortions, to sort of stop doing those abortions, right? So it opens, we have an empty board if Roe versus Wade goes away, right? There's nothing that says you can or you can't, right? So that's a vacuum that people are going to want to try to swoop into to fill, which is, as I understand it, the real motivation behind attempts to really codify the right to abortion in Vermont, so that people here can be very certain that no matter what happens in other states, that they are still able to terminate their pregnancies under appropriate conditions here in Vermont.
Right. Yes. Let's talk a bit more about that. Now, there's a proposal making its way through the Vermont legislature, Prop 5, that would permanently protect abortion rights in the state by amending the Constitution. That would make Vermont the first, it would be the first state constitutional amendment specifically protecting abortion rights. And we'll be speaking with some of the lawmakers behind that effort in a bit. But I would like to ask you for your opinion on Proposal 5. Is a constitutional amendment necessary to protecting reproductive freedom right now?
Necessary is doing a lot of work in that sentence. I don't think that the politics of Vermont are such that we would have to worry immediately that the right to an abortion would be restricted in this state. But I do think that one of the reasons you put things in constitutions is to take them, to end the arguments, right? To just clarify that the sort of one of the foundational premises of the law in a particular state is that, in this case, that people have a right to terminate their pregnancies. So by amending the Constitution, you short circuit political arguments over this. And given the vast political arguments about abortion that are ongoing in much of the rest of the country, it seems like a really sensible choice to move to really codify the right to abortion in Vermont, to just sort of take it off the board and sort of move on to all of the other things that need to happen here in Vermont.
Let's go now to Pam in Calais. Pam, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, hi. I just wanted to make a comment about these laws in other states and even though it probably won't happen here in Vermont, it really scares me for family members outside of the state. But I have, when I had a pregnancy that had to end in termination because my baby was severely deformed, and I didn't find out until like I was 11 weeks pregnant, which would have been past this 6-week thing. Yes, there was a heartbeat. These laws don't take into account situations like this that doctors know about, women that have been through this know about, and their families know about, that taking away that right could really, really, really hurt somebody. And I already had a one-year-old, and this baby was not going to make it to term, or it would have been born dead. And to put a family through that without knowing the complete story is horrific. And that's something that the anti-abortionists, they just don't understand. It's not black and white. Nothing is black and white. It's not like, oh, I want to end my pregnancy because I don't want a baby. It's not always like that. And that's something that really, really needs to be talked about and argued against with a legislation like this. It's pretty scary.
Well, Pam, thank you so much for calling in and for sharing your personal story with us. Pam mentioned that this is not a black and white issue, and yet it does seem as though the debate over abortion has become much more polarized in the past couple of decades. Ellen, would you agree?
Yes and no. So attitudes, like we've surveyed attitudes about abortion ever since Roe versus Wade, right? So we have, you know, just about 50 years of information about this. And actual attitudes about abortion haven't really shifted that much to oversimplify things. The majority of Americans believe that abortion should be legal, but also believe that there ought to be restrictions on abortions, which is to say, Americans as a whole want there to be the right, but are uncomfortable with certain kinds of abortions. And once you start getting into the weeds of what abortions should be acceptable and what abortions shouldn't be acceptable, like then chaos reigns. And what Pam is saying is exactly the kind of complicated reasoning, moral reasoning, that the Texas law completely runs roughshod over, right? So the Texas law ought to frighten everybody for a wide array of reasons. First, the law makes sort of no distinctions about sort of what's going on in the pregnancy. Is the pregnancy proceeding safely? Is the pregnancy particularly risky? The law makes no distinctions about how the pregnancy occurred. Was this the product of rape or incest? Sort of none of that matters. The law sort of refuses to recognize that sort of huge percentages of pregnancies miscarry in the first trimester, right? These numbers are enormous. It's roughly a third of all pregnancies miscarry in the first trimester, which is not something we talk about a lot, but is nonetheless true, right? And so if you have a pregnancy that miscarries, how are you supposed to show that that wasn't a voluntary termination, right? I mean, just think about that. Mm-hmm. And then on top of everything else, the notion that somehow now all of your neighbors and coworkers and PTA parents, whoever you're talking about, suddenly have this kind of interest in your body and what it's doing, should justifiably make us all very, very concerned.
We're discussing the future of abortion rights in Vermont. Over the past few decades, abortion has become one of the most polarizing issues in the country. Mary Hahn Beerworth is the executive director of the Vermont Right to Life Committee. I spoke to her yesterday about her priorities. I asked her if Vermonters who opposed abortion had been energized by the new law in Texas.
There's a very energized pro-life community out there right now. They are offended by Act 47, and now this proposal to amend the Constitution. And there is something for pro-lifers that is exciting when you hear that they are banning abortions after the heart begins to beat. And I want to be very clear about that. That's a detectable heartbeat they're talking about. That's 6 weeks into pregnancy, significant development already occurring. But that little heart was beating regularly at about 21 to 23 days after conception. So it's what they're talking about in Texas is when you can hear the sonogram and you can hear the bump, 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 bump of that little heartbeat. And yeah, that's exciting for pro-lifers because they feel that unborn human beings are part of the human family and should be protected by law.
So do you feel like there has been more organizing, more rallying or protests since this Texas decision?
Oh, I think there will be among the Planned Parenthood abortion rights crowd. They have been having rallies and they are upset at the ruling in Texas. Essentially, it's a matter of letting the states set abortion policy. And so if Vermont has the right to set a very extreme abortion policy, maybe only similar to New York and maybe California, I'm not sure. And set that policy so extreme that no protections can be offered to an unborn baby at any stage of pregnancy, then I just believe that Texas has the right to set policy. And certainly Texas voters are welcome to vote legislators out of office that they disagree with.
And what are your specific criticisms of Proposal 5 here in Vermont?
Oh, I think it's an outrageous overreach of state government in protecting unlimited, unregulated abortion and abortion providers. That number one abortion provider providing 90% of all the 1,200 abortions here in Vermont annually is Planned Parenthood. They dominated the state house, and they also use the Office of the Attorney General as sort of their private legal advice. Throughout the summer before they announced in the legislature that abortion would be the centerpiece of the 2019-2020 legislative agenda. And so essentially they have a stake in how that legislation played out to favor their political views and their business. The other about 100 or so abortions now take place at the UVM Medical Center, and a handful are done in physicians' offices, but that is the case here in Vermont. And so we object. It means far more. We think it's a legislative abdication of their responsibility. What this language will mean was we were repeatedly told when asked of the committee chairs, will it mean this? Will it mean that? And they said, well, the courts will decide. That is the answer that came back repeatedly. When you don't allow the legislative body to react to what we can't predict this language will mean, it could mean everything from some very dangerous unconstrained science. It can go as far as your imagination can let itself go. Personal reproductive autonomy will be up to the courts to decide, and we are very concerned about how we will protect the most vulnerable from some potential harm from it.
Now, Vermont's legislature is dominated by Democrats and progressives, and even Republican Governor Phil Scott says he supports a woman's right to choose. So what do you see as your achievable goal here? Do you believe that people who are against abortion rights could change the discussion around this issue, or is Prop 5 kind of on its way to being passed?
Yeah, I definitely think it's on its way for passing that final time in the House, though there will be a fight. But this is a huge opportunity for us. We're probably going to be grateful in the end that we have an opportunity to speak to every household in Vermont and inform Vermont voters what they didn't already know. They don't know. We do our public opinion polling, and yeah, most Vermonters, a large majority of Vermonters call themselves pro-choice. But once you get down to it, they don't consider that an unborn child has zero value. They don't consider that they want women to be involved in something that could harm them. And there are lots of pieces of the legislation that we get good support from, including parents of a minor being informed so they can know what's happening to their minor daughter, including fetal homicide laws so we could protect an unborn child under state statute from being the victim of gross purposeful negligence or homicide. We have none of those things in place. And this constitutional amendment will seal that in granite for years and years to come.
That was Mary Hahn Beerworth, the executive director of the Vermont Right to Life Committee. I'd like to bring into the conversation Lucy LaRiche. She's the vice president of Vermont Public Policy at Planned Parenthood Northern New England. And Becca Ballant, Vermont's Senate pro tem and one of the sponsors of Prop 5. Welcome to both of you.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
Senator Ballant, let's start with you. I'm curious to hear what you thought of Mary Beerworth's point at the end there about how Prop 5 provides an opportunity for anti-abortion activists to push for more protections for, as she puts it, the unborn child. What did you think when you heard that?
Well, I just want to be clear that the Reproductive Liberty Amendment that we passed twice in the Senate with overwhelming support, it does not fundamentally change Vermont's medical standards and guidance when it comes to reproductive health. What the amendment does is just protect reproductive liberty for all Vermonters, for men and women, long term, so that we as Vermonters can make decisions about our own bodies and not have our rights be subject to the whims of whatever politicians have to be in place. So we welcome this conversation. We think when Vermonters know what's at stake here, they'll understand that these deeply personal and complex decisions that Vermonters made are no different from the decisions that they've made for the last 50 years here in Vermont, that we believe that Vermonters can make these decisions between themselves and their provider. And so this amendment simply says it affirms what we're already doing. We believe women and men have a right to make decisions about their reproductive health. So we welcome the conversation. We believe that we have the stronger argument.
Now, Lucy, Mary Hahn Beerworth also said that people against abortion are feeling this renewed sense of purpose these days. Do you feel the same about your colleagues at Planned Parenthood and abortion rights activists more broadly?
Oh, absolutely. People are really fired up and energized. This Texas law is an absolute outrage. It's shocking that we are creating a vigilante justice kind of system to allow people to attack and harass people for potentially trivial reasons, having nothing to do with abortion, but land out outrageous allegations. We see, in addition, politicians in other states who are scrambling to enact and to bring forward copycat laws for Texas. So yeah, I would say this, I think people who have been in the abortion rights movement are incredibly committed. We know that this is really about individual justice for existing human beings and that we are once again under attack by the Supreme Court, by laws that regressive legislatures like Texas are moving forward, and it's up to us because we know that the majority of people understand that pregnancy is a complex state of biology, and that there is no way that we can legislate all of the potential complications that can happen in any given pregnancy. And for the last almost 50 years, Vermont has seen incredibly good health outcomes and we have not had these laws that exist in other states. We have had the ability for individuals in our state to be able to make their own life decisions and their own medical decisions with their families and their doctors and friends and people of faith. Mm-hmm. So, yes, I would say absolutely Vermonters are in our movement are absolutely shocked and fired up.
Let's go now to Joseph in St. Johnsbury. Joseph, you are on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, I was just wanted to make the remark that the anti-abortion movement is basically overthrown the church. In many churches, not so much lately, but in the past, You weren't even considered a Christian if you weren't into the anti-abortion movement. It was like a bizarre disease that overran a lot of the churches. And nowhere in the Bible does it say you have to join some political movement to be honoring to God and to be a part of his kingdom here on earth. And a lot of so-called Christians that are anti-abortion won't cross the street to help anybody who was in any kind of suffering. Or it's just an overwhelming nightmare that they look at one side of the issue or get swept up in a political hailstorm. And that's why you have leadership who, you know, cross the line on the issue, like some Catholics are pro-abortion because they realize. Right.
Joseph, I'm just going to cut in there because I'd like to have our guests respond to your point. Lucy, Vermont is one of the more non-religious states in the country. According to Pew, just 32% of Vermonters say religion is very important to them compared to, say, Texas, where it's double that. Do you think that has anything to do with Vermonters' attitudes on abortion rights?
I think Vermonters' attitudes about abortion rights are really come down to fundamental individual autonomy and a respect for human beings. So in Vermont, we have... it's true, we're not the most religious state in the country, but we also know that there are people of faith and faith leaders in Vermont who are very who very much respect personal healthcare decisions. And in fact, we noticed that there was a letter, an op-ed that was signed. I can't remember the number, but over a dozen faith leaders across the state from many different denominations and faiths who signed a letter in support of the Reproductive Liberty Amendment. This is not the religious community and communities of faith do not have a corner of the market on or the dominant voice on whether or not abortion should be legal. There are some strong faiths who try to paint that picture and try to create that perception, but in fact, many people of faith do indeed support abortion rights.
Now, I want to talk a bit more about the logistics of Prop 5 and what's coming down the pike. And to do that, let's bring in Representative Ann Pugh, who represents Chittenden County. Representative Pugh, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
Now, first, Senator Ballant and then Representative Pugh, can you tell me a little bit about how Prop 5 is working its way through the legislature? What's already happened and what's coming up next?
Yes, this is Senator Ballant. Would you like me to start?
Yes, please.
Okay, so just so that Vermonters know who may be listening, proposals of amendment to the Constitution can be initiated every 4 years. By the Senate, and a proposal must be approved by two-thirds of the Senate. So that's 20 votes before being sent over to the House. So we have to then pass the proposals by two consecutive legislative sessions. So we passed Prop 5 first in the Senate on April 15th, 2019, on a very strong vote of 28-2, and then again on April 9th, 2021, on a vote of 26-4. So because it has passed two consecutive terms of the Senate, it now goes over to the House for their piece in this, and then it will go out to voters. So we'll have Ann talk about what it looks like on her side of the building.
Thank you. And I guess I want to reiterate and repeat what is Proposition 5. Proposition 5 keeps things the way they are right now in Vermont, and the way they've been for over 50 years. Vermonters have, for years, our policy has long recognized that decisions related to reproductive health care and abortion are deeply personal and private and are best left to the individual and their health care provider. And this Reproductive Liberty Amendment will be the umbrella under which other state policies and laws around reproductive liberty, when and whether to have children, would stand. It restricts, but it does not eliminate the ability of the state to regulate. So I just wanted to reinforce that.
Thank you. So what's coming up next for the legislation?
Okay, what's coming up next is... now that the Senate has passed for the second time, House rules have outlined a very clear process. The proposal will be has been referred to the House Human Services Committee, which is a policy of the Policy Committee of Jurisdiction. We need to have the committee needs to conduct a public hearing, as we did in the first biennium, and which we will do. And when the committee votes the proposition out of reproductive liberty amendment out to the House floor, we will the House floor will needs to be on the notice calendar for 4 legislative days and will be up for action on the 5th legislative day. This is an issue that is one of many, but an important priority of the Speaker of the House and of me and of many members of the House. And we anticipate taking it up before the town meeting recess.
Thank you. And we will continue to keep an eye on that as well. I'd like to turn back to the phones now. We have Mish in Plainfield. Mish, you are on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi there. Very simple. Don't like abortion? Don't have one, because that element is not forbidden in my religion, and I'm tired of having people try to impose their questionable religious beliefs on non-believers. That's all.
Thank you, Mish, for that concise comment. Lucy, I'm curious if you could respond to that. Do you feel like Mish's statement is sort of a centerpiece of what you're trying to communicate?
Well, yeah, sure. It's spot on. This is a civil rights issue. Let's be clear. This is about human beings having the ability to make decisions that anyone with full personhood would be granted. I mean, I don't know how to say it any clearer. I think Mish said it exactly right. This is about basic human rights and dignity, and that honestly, my healthcare decisions aren't anyone's business but my own and my doctor's.
Let's go down go ahead. Yes, who is this? Senator Ballant?
No, it's Representative Pugh.
Yes. Go ahead, please.
I want to make it clear that the Reproductive Liberty Amendment, when it passes the House and goes to the governor, is the decision to amend. It gives the decision to Vermont's voters. It gives Vermonters the opportunity in November of 2022 mm-hmm. to decide if reproductive liberty should be protected in the Constitution. So what this process does is bring it to the voters.
All right. And we will certainly keep an eye on that when it comes to the voters in November. Let's go now to...
Of 2022.
Of 2022, yes. Let's go now to Vera in West Chazy, New York. Vera, you are on the air. Go ahead.
Yes, I would like to mention that it's never brought up that females do not impregnate themselves, and neither does the Holy Ghost. And anyone who is opposed to abortion is anti-feminine. They don't help females. They just encourage males to not be responsible for the act. And that's my point. I've seen it. I'm 92 years old, and I've heard this ever since my teens. It's always an objection. It's always the woman's responsibility, as if she impregnated herself. There's no address of where it happened and how it came about. That males, that'll be the Frosty Friday, when males have to have a written document before they can impregnate a female. And I'll try not to be so angry next time. Bye-bye.
Thank you for your call, Vera, and for introducing me to the phrase Frosty Friday.
Frosty Friday.
I would like to bring one more voice into this conversation now, Marissa Coleman. She is a psychologist and the University of Vermont Medical Center's first president of Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion. Marissa Coleman, welcome to the program, and congratulations on your new position.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm happy to be here.
I'm wondering if you could detail for us UVM Medical Center's general policies around training medical students on reproductive rights and procedures.
I am not directly involved with the training of the medical students, but I will say that University of Vermont Medical Center provides a full range of reproductive health care services to our patients who need them, including abortion. We have strong policies and do everything in our power to limit staff involvement and learner involvement in pregnancy termination cases to staff that have opted in or out.
Now, if access to abortion does become curtailed, how could that affect Vermont's low-income population and people of color specifically?
Have a direct impact. You know, I've enjoyed the conversation thus far this hour, and I want to also highlight and reiterate that reproductive justice is a human rights issue. Indigenous women, women of color, and trans people have always fought for reproductive justice and have also been at the receiving end of extreme disparities when this right is threatened.
And do you think, in your opinion, there's a system in which people who are against abortion and people who support reproductive rights can both exist comfortably together? Because as we've heard throughout this past hour, there is such divide on this issue, both nationally and right here in Vermont.
Yeah, you know, I there is an incredible divide. And, you know, where I come back to, again, is just honoring the dignity and the full humanity of every individual. And so if there is a place for us to come together on either sides of the issue, that would be what I believe would join us. There are a number of things that need to happen in order for that to take place, especially when it comes to advocating for women of color, trans people, and low-income individuals.
Lucy LaRiche with Planned Parenthood. I'm wondering if you can talk specifically about whether and how you and your colleagues are doing that work that Marissa Coleman is talking about advocating for women of color and for people who are low income who might be particularly affected by a change to reproductive rights.
Yeah, this is critically important. We are developing our campaign and our strategy to talk to Vermonters about this amendment. We are centering the voices of the people who would be most affected. And as Marissa so aptly stated, this is really about Black, Indigenous, people of color, people in very rural locations who have transportation issues, and people with low income. Unfortunately, the amendment doesn't reach into some reproductive justice issues around economics, but access is at the heart of this. So in other words, the amendment would just simply prohibit government interference from someone being able to access basic reproductive health care.
Now, Marissa Coleman, I'm wondering if you have thoughts or advice on how to take into account the backgrounds, the social religious backgrounds of new Vermonters in this conversation, people who are moving here from other countries that might have very different, say, religious beliefs than the quote unquote typical Vermonter.
I appreciate that question because I think it's really important to bring all individuals into the conversation. What I always start with when I'm trying to understand perhaps an experience, a lived experience, or a perspective that is different than my own is I listen. And then I want to hear what they have to say before I act or interject my own opinions, because we all have inherent blind spots. And so if there are communities that need to be brought into this conversation that have not been, the first thing to do would be to listen to what their perspectives are and what their needs are and not assume.
Professor Ellen Anderson, I'd like to bring you back into the conversation. Thank you so much for waiting patiently on the line. You're a professor of constitutional law, politics of sexuality, American politics, and I'm curious to hear if and how this debate over abortion rights comes up in your classrooms at the University of Vermont.
Well, the University of Vermont, is in a reasonably liberal state, and students at UVM tend to be reasonably liberal, heavily pro-choice, And so the big thing that happens in my classrooms is having to try to explain to my students why it is that other people might not agree with their understanding of the reproductive rights of pregnant people. Right. And one of the big problems we face in this country today is that we are so polarized into sort of these two discrete camps that we forget to recognize that people that we disagree with are as fully human as we are. Right. And that that they have deeply held fundamental beliefs that drive their attitudes and belief systems. So, and even though I, on a personal level, I tend to believe the same thing as the great bulk of my students, which is it is very difficult to conceive of a world in which people who can be pregnant and give birth are fully fledged human beings who have a full set of rights if they don't have reproductive autonomy. I mean, I agree with that, that reproductive autonomy is really central to what it means to be a full citizen, a full person in this society. I think it's really important that we understand the other side and recognize that that people that we disagree with also have really coherent political beliefs that matter deeply to them.
Speaking of those political beliefs, Senator Ballin, I'm wondering if you can talk to us about how you have reached across the aisle to work with your colleagues in the Senate who might very much disagree with Proposal 5.
So I want to just remind everybody what I said earlier is that we had really strong passages of both times that we brought this amendment up in the Senate, and we did have Democrats and Republicans voting in support of the Reproductive Liberty Amendment. And so I think there's a lot that we agree on. And many of my colleagues who do identify as more right-leaning, many of them also believe that healthcare decisions need to be made between a patient and a healthcare provider, and not by politicians and not by religious leaders. If people individually feel that they have a religious belief that prevents them from seeking an abortion, then that is absolutely within their spiritual and religious right and within their life. But we should not be imposing that on others. And I think many of my colleagues agree with that, regardless of their political persuasion. We have on our flag freedom and unity. And freedom comes first because we believe that people should have the ability to make these choices for themselves in consultation with their healthcare providers.
Let's go now to Kathy in Essex. Kathy, you are on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi. Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. I just want to merely mention, I mean, I'm very much into this whole conversation, listening to the religious, intellectual, political reasons and statements why this is such a hot topic. And I just don't want to leave emotion out of it. I think for many women making these decisions, they are not easy decisions to make. This is not an easy decision to make to choose to end a pregnancy for any reason. So I just wanted to throw that in the mix that these are heavy conversations, and they're heavy intellectual conversations, but they're also really heavy emotional conversations. And nobody takes these decisions lightly. And wherever an individual person falls on any of that spectrum, I agree, it's their choice. It's their choice with their family. It's their choice with themselves. And it is their choice with their medical and religious support. So I don't want to miss the emotional piece.
Kathy, thank you for your call. And Marissa Coleman, I would like you to respond to that as a psychologist. What role does, emotion play into this debate?
You know, I appreciate that statement because emotion absolutely plays a central part of it. I mean, we aren't disconnected from our feeling states and from our lived experiences when we think about the connection between our thoughts, our feelings, and our behaviors. There's one thing that I want to make sure to also highlight that I think is really important is that, you know, when we are looking to achieve reproductive justice, joining together across issues and identities is central. You know, the fact and the acknowledgement that all oppressions impact our reproductive lives is incredibly nuanced, and looking at reproductive justice through the lens of nuanced ways of oppression and how that impacts self-determined family creation is really crucial. There are communities of color, women of color that have been leading this movement, and I would love to see their voices more centrally located within the debates.
Professor Anderson, the U.S. Department of Justice is in the process of challenging Texas's abortion law. And just yesterday, Vermont's attorney general joined 24 other attorneys general in filing an amicus brief in support of the Department of Justice. I'm curious, do you think this amicus brief will have any sort of tangible effect, or are these things today more about value signaling?
Amicus briefs are usually paid attention to by the courts when they come from other political actors. So that, you know, when the attorneys general of states sign on to briefs, I mean, they're really saying we are, you know, we as states are important political actors in the United States, and you should listen to our voice. So I do think that these briefs, they are signaling. I mean, you're right that they're signaling, but they are a signal that courts tend to pay careful attention to.
Thank you for that. And I thank you to the callers who called in who we didn't get to. We're going to wrap things up here because I have many, many people to thank for this show. First, Ellen Anderson, a professor at the University of Vermont. We have Lucy LaRiche with Planned Parenthood, Senator Becca Ballant and Ann Pugh, Representative Ann Pugh, and Marissa Coleman, a psychologist in the University of Vermont Medical Center's first vice president of diversity, equity, and inclusion. Thank you to all of you for joining this conversation today.